life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Dreamtime invites you to spend the next hour unlocking the mystery of dreaming. Host Bob Haas and his guests from the International Association for the Study of Dreams will help you understand your dreams and their impact on your daily life. Now here's your host, Bob Haas.
Welcome to the second series of Dreamtime, a 14-week series on the topic of dreams. This is the second to the last show. We'll be keeping it up a bit online after that, so you can always have a chance to come back and listen to it. I am your host, Bob Haas, Executive Officer of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. And the focus of this second series is dream research and discovery, understanding some of the most recent findings about dreams from researchers and other professionals in the field. And today the show will focus on dreams and nightmare research in Canada with our guest, Dr. Tori Nielsen, Director of the Dream and Nightmare Lab in Montreal. Now, Dr. Nielsen is the director of this laboratory, which he founded in 1991, and it's located in the Research Center of Montreal's Sacré-Cœur Hospital. He is a full professor in the psychiatry department of the University of Montreal and past board member of the International Association for the Study of Dreams and was a past editor for their newsletter. Information on Tori can be found at jtkresearch.com/dreamlab. Now, today we also have a co-host, Lainey Dolphin. She is the author of Dreams Do Come True, Decoding Your Dreams to Discover Your Full Potential. She is the founder of the Dream Interpretation Center in Montreal. She has a certificate in Gestalt Counseling and is on the board of the International Association for the Study of Dreams. Lainey is the host of the 25th Annual IASD Conference to be held in Montreal in 2008 and will be telling us a bit about that conference during the show. Well, welcome to the show, Tori and Lainey.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Hey there, Bob.
Yeah, lady. Okay, what we're going to do on the show is both Lainey and I will be asking you various questions, Dr. Nielsen, so bear with us as we hit you from both sides.
All right.
Okay. But first, I think that a lot of folks would like to know about how you became interested in researching dreams and in particular nightmares.
Well, like a lot of people in the association, I think I got my first interest in dreams at a very young age. I was one of those big dreamers as a preschooler. You know, I had a lot of nightmares as a kid. I had a lot of lucid dreams, dreams of floating around my bedroom, and so forth, and from a very young age. And then it just built from there. Through a series of fortunate events, I guess, I met people who wrote their dreams in diaries, and people actually studied them, and I got more and more interested in it. I met Don Kiken at Edmonton, at the University of Alberta, and he offered me my first program in studying dreams, and then from there I went to Montreal and got my first postdoctoral job with Jacques Monplaisir at the Sleep Center, and I established the Dream Lab, and I've been studying them ever since. Haven't read a minute of it, really.
Did this inspire you to go into psychology? Was it the dream activity, or was psychology a bigger interest?
Well, yes, that was, I guess, one of the inspirations was, I've always been a people person, interested in human nature,
yeah.
Curious, maybe nosy, some people might say, but having my own vast experience of what the mind can do and can be, I guess, drove me in that direction for sure.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about how you actually got the Nightmare Research Laboratory started and what that was all about.
Well, I saw a need for dream research at the time, back in the late 80s when I first came to Montreal, and I set about, finding funding. That's the main thing. It's, I guess, a laboratory is like a researcher's business. I needed backers and I needed people to work there. And so through the graces of a number of different levels of funding, organizations like the Canadian Institutes of Health Research and the Sacré-Cœur Hospital, the Quebec Mental Health Network, I I raised the money. It takes, you know, several hundred thousand dollars to buy the polysomnograph that you need to study sleep and the equipment, the electrodes and so forth. And then, of course, you have to pay people to work nights.
For sure.
That's the hard part.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's taken time, but the funding has been pretty good in Canada. We've managed to keep our own through the years. And, of course, studying nightmares as well as dreams is an important part of the mission of the lab, because the nightmare side is really the mental health
mm-hmm.
side. You know, dream research per se is maybe not the most popular area to fund in any country, but nightmares, on the other hand, are very important for people with post-traumatic stress disorder, people who are depressed, a number of psychiatric problems.
And a good example is for nightmares is my own daughter, who just gave birth to my granddaughter about 5 months ago, and she was having nightmares. And I think that you've done some specific research about nightmares of new mothers.
It's true. It's been in the media since the beginning of September. I can't believe the response we've been getting to this study. We studied several hundred new mothers. And it turns out that a large proportion of them have nightmares about their infants. It's a very stressful time. Their sleep is disrupted enormously.
Mm.
And so their sleep cycles are quite disturbed, and nightmares seem to be produced in this kind of milieu. And they're dreaming in a very particular way. They're dreaming about their infants being lost or in danger or threatened. And very often lost somewhere in the bed. We coined the phrase baby in bed dreams, or bib dreams, to describe this experience. The mother wakes up frantically searching the bed looking for the missing infant, afraid that, you know, she'll roll over on the child and smother the child, or, you know, accidentally hit it or something. It's a surprisingly high number of women have this, and we've been getting all kinds of emails from women all around the world saying, oh yes, my goodness, I've been having this for 20 years. My grandmother had them, you know.
So it seems pretty normal.
Yeah. Well, what have you discovered, though, with this research so far?
Well, apart from just pointing my finger at the phenomenon and saying, look, this is here, and it's affecting women all over the place, we've found that there is kind of a configuration of sleep and stress and emotions that will lead to a kind of nightmare in which, you know, not only is the woman fearful of hurting the child, but is moving around. You see, this is the important part. There is a motor activity. The woman's looking around the bed, sitting up, sometimes believes that she's holding the child in her arms and rocking it, will grope the husband. Sometimes will get right out of bed and somnambulate. Yet it's not somnambulism. It's bona fide dreaming. We don't know if it's REM sleep per se, but and this is actually quite rare. You don't see nightmares with a lot of motor activity like this.
Yeah.
So it's more like the Hollywood stereotype that we're seeing here. And so now we're looking for instances in which this might occur in other places. I don't know, you know, people working as guards at night, you know, where their sleep is quite
right. Those nighttime jobs.
Yeah, to see if is it something specific to the postpartum state, you know, where hormones are quite in disarray, or is it something that has to do with sleep just being disrupted and, you know, the stress, the importance of the job that you're doing, sort of interacting with that. And we don't know yet whether it's a more general phenomenon, but I do hear a lot of stories from people, you know, a lot
right.
of anecdotes. But.
And it's interesting because you're, like, touching on all the subjects that I'm actually experiencing in my life. Because I have another granddaughter who's just a preschooler who also experiences some nightmares, and I understand that you've done research on that subject as well. So you're focused on new mothers and little kids,
yeah.
which is interesting. It's interesting. interesting.
Yes, it's true. My graduate student, Valerie Simara, is heading this research, and she saw some quite interesting things. First of all, we found that nightmares in preschoolers are actually less frequent than you might think. And we're talking now about a sample of almost 1,000 kids that are representative of the entire province of Quebec. Okay, so the generalizability of our findings is quite high. And we were quite surprised to see that, you know, the rate of nightmares in preschoolers was less than 4%, because most people think that it's much higher. But besides that, what's I find most interesting in this work is that we found some predictors of who will report nightmares at this age. And it turns out that there are some predictors as early as 5 months of age that are associated with future nightmares.
Really?
Yeah, and of course at 5 months you have to depend upon the mother's ratings.
What sort of predictors?
Well, what we call difficult behavior.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a kind of a subjective measure, but it probably translates into a child being hard to handle, maybe anxious at an early age. At 17 months, it's quite clear that it's anxious behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The child is showing signs already at 17 months of anxiety. And that as well predicts the future nightmares. So what we think we're seeing is the very origins of this diathesis stress interaction, which is really... well, we think an innate disposition to nightmares that is being brought forth by stressful life experience. And it's very early to be detecting it, but...
Is the nightmare just a reflection of this difficult time the child is having orienting himself?
Yeah, there could be a predisposition already, perhaps inherited,
uh-huh.
That is being brought out by a series of stressful events. Now, in adults, we know that a single trauma can often bring about nightmares. But at this early stage of development, it could be more like a series of events, none of which is maybe... considered traumatic by the DSM-4 or other diagnoses, but it could be something as simple as having a pet die, or it could be serious as say not being nurtured enough by the parents, attachment difficulties, but that over time this kind of stress will accumulate and bring out nightmares.
Okay, well, on that note, we need to take a short break. Lainey and I will be right back with our guest, Dr. Tori Nielsen, director of the Dream and Nightmare Laboratory in Montreal.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Dream Science Foundation, in partnership with International Association for the Study of Dreams, welcomes all who are interested in understanding dreams from the perspective of the researchers and professionals in the field. This show is sponsored by DreamScience.org in conjunction with the International Association for the Study of Dreams and by the book Dream Language by Robert Haas, which contains topics from this series and content from many of the guests who are appearing. Join us at the annual conference for the International Association for the Study of Dreams, June 29th through July 3rd at Sonoma State University in California for over 160 presentations from all over the globe on dreams and dream work. For more information on this conference or to order Bob's book, Dream Language, visit www.asdreams.org or www.dreamscience.org.
Trying to get pregnant? Need vital information on fertility and reproduction? Then tune in to HaveABaby.com Live with host Kim Hahn, brought to you by the Scher Institutes for Reproductive Medicine. From enhanced embryo selection and male infertility to third-party reproduction and pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, Kim Hahn and the doctors from the Scher Institutes cover the questions and concerns that couples face when they are trying to have a family. HaveABaby.com Live with host Kim Hahn broadcasts each Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. HaveABaby.com Live, sponsored by the Scher Institutes for Reproductive Medicine, helping couples go from infertility to family.
for the most current and up-to-date information and options in childbearing, family health, and parenting. Tune in to Celesta Ranisi's Timely Topics in Childbirth, broadcasting every Wednesday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. If you don't know your options, you don't have any.
Helping you make informed decisions for your life. This is Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to Dreamtime with Bob Haas. If you have a question or comment, call us toll-free at 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Bob.
Welcome back to Dreamtime. Today we're discussing dreams and nightmare research in Canada with our guest, Dr. Tori Nielsen, Director of the Dream and Nightmare Laboratory in Montreal. Well, Tori, before we took the break, you were talking about work you were doing with preschool children, and it brought about a question where, you know, nightmare suffering can be really kind of debilitating at times. I have known I've run into a number of people in just work I've done where people are just they're afraid to go to sleep. And I understand you've been testing a new treatment for nightmares. It particularly might work with mothers, preschool children, everybody. So how does that work? Maybe our audience could even use some of those tips.
Yes. Well, I could actually say two things about that. The epidemiological research that I was just talking about has shown us that the chances of having a nightmare are reduced if parents actually comfort the children at night. And this is an important point because a lot of other research suggests that comforting children at night may lead to sleep disorders of different kinds. And we're in fact exploring that question more right now, but it turns out that helping them with their nightmares like this, providing comfort, closeness, and talking about it and so forth is a protective factor. So that's one thing that preschool or parents can use, but the method that you're talking about is something different, and we use it more with older kids up to age 11, and that is simply a modified drawing technique. Now this is not original. We decided to test something that's been used for years, for decades, by different people out there, seemingly successfully. And that is to ask the child to draw the nightmare. And so we've got a protocol in place where we are actually testing two different conditions. One, the child simply draws the nightmare as it occurred. Another condition is that the child draws the nightmare but then changes it in some way. And that's a pretty common technique that's used by psychologists and dream workers. And but we've set it up so that we can compare these conditions, and we have an added component which is usually not ever controlled for by dream workers and psychologists, and that's this relating the dream, because usually children are asked to relate the dream and to draw the dream. And so in our study we have the kids call our lab. We have an automated voicemail system which the kids love, by the way. They get to use the keyboard on the telephone to answer questions about their dreams. You know, they rate them on a 1 to 9
technology.
Yeah, it's great. They love it. And then they relate their dream, their nightmare, and it's recorded as an MP3 file. And so that's part of the process, and we can compare our treatment conditions with just a group that does only that to see if that has any effect. But I'll talk just about the drawing part, because it seems to be working very well. The kids respond very well to it. We give them crayons and paper, and every time they have a nightmare, they draw it. And so far, my grad student, Valerie Samar, she's been doing this, has found great success. She's in the process of writing it up for a publication right now. We're also trying the same technique with adults. And there, I would say it's also successful, but not everyone is really interested in doing that. They have the choice, obviously, of participating or not, and some decline. And so I think there has to be an aptitude there for drawing. A lot of adults don't really see the connection or see the value, but others are really looking for a non-drug-based therapy for their nightmares, and so they give it a try. And we're finding that it is also successful when they apply themselves.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a variation of Jung's active imagination, but on paper.
Yeah, it is, in fact. You could also see it as a variation of the imagery rehearsal treatment that's so popular right now, where people are taught just to imagine a new ending or some change to their nightmare in their mind's eye. So here we have it on paper.
How have you measured the effectivity of it? Does one method over another seem to be any better?
Well, we use the voicemail again because when they phone in, and they do this on a daily basis, mm-hmm. the computer asks some questions.
Well, nice.
Computer, we have a pre-recorded experimenter's voice, asks the question, you know, did you do your drawing last night? And then they have to answer yes or no. So it gives us a very good method for following compliance with treatment. And, of course, we also give questionnaires before and after treatment.
To determine whether the nightmares are reduced or...
And we're finding that in the adults, the voicemail itself seems to be an effective tool. The drawing adds to that, but the voicemail, we were surprised, which was supposed to be our control condition, it also seems to help nightmare suffering. So
the whole world is turning virtual. We now have virtual psychologists.
Right. Just having a listening ear, even if it's a pre-recorded one,
helps.
A quick question about another little technique I tried with, well, particularly with children, is having the child turn around and face the monster. I mean, you have to sort of force lucidity with that, but I had a little cousin that was having some real problems with nightmares, and so one morning I was talking to her, and I just said, well, tonight, if you dream of the monster, just turn around and hug the monster. And so the next day I asked her, not expecting anything to have happen, and I said, did you have a dream last night? She says, yeah, I dreamed of the monster. I said, well, what'd you do? She said, I turned around and faced it just like you said, and I hugged it. And I said, what happened? The monster was my mommy. Change. So that was interesting.
Well, I think I prefer that approach to simply telling the child, oh, it was only a dream.
Yeah.
When discrediting the dream, I think you can give them some pointers and some tips for what to do, because it does tend to seep into the dream world, this advice.
Yeah.
And has your research led you to a specific theory or model for nightmare pathology?
Well, I'm actively working on models all the time. I mentioned this diathesis stress idea, sort of a modified notion. And that, you know, nightmares are partly inherited and then partly brought out by an accumulation of stress throughout life.
Right.
But in addition to that, I've added a kind of component which speculates about the function of dreaming. You know, I think in order to have a good model of nightmares, you need to have a model of dream function. And so I'm proposing that dreaming is... it serves the purpose of helping us to extinguish fear memories or to create what we call fear extinction memories. This is a new concept in neuroscience, and there's a lot of support for it in animal studies particularly, what's called fear extinction memories. We all have fear memories. We all know what those are.
Right.
But in order to deal with our fears, we don't simply eliminate the fears from our system. We can't just go in and undo something that we learned, especially something traumatic, that doesn't get undone that easily. But we can learn to, we can create memories that effectively will suppress or supplant the fear memories. And these are brand new memories, and they coexist with the fear memories, and yet they suppress them. And the reason we know they coexist is because the fear memories can come back, even though we've learned to extinguish our fear by a new memory. If we don't maintain those fear extinction memories, it takes some maintenance work, the original fear memory will come back. It's still there.
Is it that we're suppressing the response, or changing the response, say, that the amygdala might have to these memories, or that it is actually a separate memory that's vying for attention?
Well, yes. In fact, I think the amygdala is involved. I think the hippocampus is involved as well, because the fear extinction memory in animals, it's been shown that the way this is done is by exposing the subject to a fearful stimulus, but in a different environment.
In a calming environment, right?
That's right. And so this is a new memory that, I'm in this environment, but the same stimulus doesn't evoke the same fear in me. So I've just laid down a new memory trace. And by repeating this, say, same fear in many different environments, eventually there is this ability to suppress the fear. And I think that's what's happening during dreaming.
Well, it's
dreaming,
the exact same
bring up fearful things.
Yeah, exact same.
But it's always in a strange environment. It's almost as if the mind is using its ability to draw up creative, unexpected environments and objects and things.
Where you get to, practice.
Right.
It's the new memory.
Yeah, it may even happen automatically. The fear is there, but yet it's in such a strange place that the fear doesn't really go anywhere, and a new fear memory, extinction memory, takes its place.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the same principle they use with EFT and energy psychology and all this, is the extinction principle. And part of the theory there is it's really replacing the response that the amygdala, hippocampus, the whole limbic system has to the fear, because you replaced it with a calming, calming environment.
Yeah.
So it no longer sees it as a fearful thing. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, systematic desensitization therapy is exactly that. Imagine whatever phobic object you have while you're in a relaxed state, and the two are incompatible, and you desensitize the phobia.
Well, how interesting. So
it could be that REM sleep is contributing to that by paralyzing us. That is, we're not able to evoke as much emotion, perhaps. It's another possibility.
Yeah. So what do you think are some of the key, really useful aspects of this model? I can see a bunch of them, but...
Yeah, well, it's still early in the game. The model was just published this year, but some of the advantages, I think, are, first of all, it's easily testable. I mean, it's based on contemporary neuroscience learning theory, and those principles are well articulated, so a person can go in and test my ideas quite readily. And especially one of our assumptions in the model, I say our because Ross Levin in New York helped me design this model, is what we say is a cross-state assumption. That is, we think that whatever goes wrong in nightmares should also be visible in the waking state. So we don't have to necessarily study the person while they're asleep to get at what the dysfunction is or the key dynamic. We can also give them tests in the waking state. And this, surprisingly, hasn't been done very much with nightmare subjects, giving them a neurocognitive test and so forth.
Great. Well, it looks like we've got to take another short break, and Lainey and I will be right back with our guest, Dr. Tori Nielsen, director of the Dream and Nightmare Laboratory in Montreal. When we come back, phone lines will be open, so please call us with any questions you might have.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Dream Science Foundation, in partnership with International Association for the Study of Dreams, welcomes all who are interested in understanding dreams from the perspective of the researchers and professionals in the field. The show is sponsored by DreamScience.org in conjunction with the International Association for the Study of Dreams and by the book Dream Language by Robert Haas, which contains topics from this series and content from many of the guests who are appearing. Join us at the annual conference for the International Association for the Study of Dreams, June 29th through July 3rd at Sonoma State University in California, for over 160 presentations from all over the globe on dreams and dream work. For more information on this conference or to order Bob's book, Dream Language, visit www.asdreams.org or www.dreamscience.org.
I can take care of myself. I can make a peanut butter sandwich. I can brush my teeth and I can give myself a bath. I can walk home alone from school. I can pick dinner from the trash behind the deli. I can watch the baby for the whole weekend. I can keep a baseball bat by my bed just in case there's trouble. Don't worry about me. I can take care of myself.
If you're in jail, who'll be there to take care of your family? Something to think about before committing a gun crime. Gun crimes hit home. This message brought to you by Project Safe Neighborhoods and the Ad Council.
Painful feet can affect our ability to enjoy the most basic activities in our daily lives, like walking your dog or cleaning your house, not to mention any physical activities you engage in. Thankfully, Dr. Larry Skor brings to Voice America Health and Wellness Channel timely advice and resources to get you back on your feet and feeling great. Don't miss There's No Business Like Toe Business every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to Dreamtime with Bob Haas. If you have a question or comment, call us toll-free at 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Bob.
Welcome back to Dreamtime. Today we're discussing dreams and nightmare research in Canada with our guest, Dr. Tori Nielsen, director of the Dream and Nightmare Laboratory in Montreal. Before we begin this segment, I'd like to ask our co-host, Lainey Dolphin, who is the host of the 25th IASD conference to be held in Montreal, Canada next year, to say a few words about that conference. Lainey.
Hi. Well, we're very excited about that conference, and the theme is called Dreams Without Borders. It's kind of a metaphor for what being in IASD is like anyways, because the organization is so multidisciplined and respects dreamers and their philosophies from all over the world. So just playing on that theme, we're going to do Dreams Without Borders, and one of our keynote speakers here in Montreal is going to be Tori Nielsen, who's going to talk about the title of his presentation is Normal and Pathological Dreaming, Current Research from the Montreal Dream and Nightmare Laboratory. So he'll be discussing some of the things that Tori's talking about with us today. And we also invited Milton Kramer, who is also a past president of IASD, and he's going to be talking about the dream experience, which will review a brief review of historical interest in dreaming and why we study dreaming. And it's going to place dreaming during sleep and give evidence to support our ability to collect and quantify dreaming. And he's a brilliant guy. I know Dr. Kramer for a lot of years and really enjoy him. And he's currently actually a visiting clinical professor of psychiatry at the College of Medicine of the University of Illinois in Chicago. And the conference is going to take place at the Auberge Universelle, which is right exactly next door to the Olympic Stadium, and right across the street from
the Botanical Gardens.
Yeah, which is really, really quite a beautiful setting. And just seeing the Olympic Stadium right there next to the hotel is pretty pretty dreamlike anyway.
and I think we ought to tell our guests, too, that this conference, even though it's just filled with the professionals in the field, it's for everybody. Everybody can come, anybody interested in dreams, not just a scientific conference. In fact, we involve the arts
and the humanities. I've even heard a Tibetan monk speak in Hawaii at IASD.
Right, drumming and all. So so it's a lot of fun, and every night there's receptions and things where you can meet a lot of these people and authors that you've read their books and you'd love to actually meet them. Well, they'll be there. And I think the other thing we ought to mention is we have the dream ball. The whole thing ends with the dream ball, which everybody dresses up like their favorite dream character.
And that's where you can see some very famous dream authors and researchers who may walk in dressed like a lizard. So you never know what you're going to find at the dream ball.
So you're not saying what you're going to wear, right, lady?
No, I'm not saying what I'm going to wear.
Okay.
It's always a surprise. And I want to also mention that two Montrealers, actually, Fariba Bogsaran and Danielle Delorier, who originate from Montreal and now live and work in California, they will be doing our 25th anniversary opening night, and they're going to do a multimedia presentation titled One Night of Sleep, The Art of Science and Dreaming. And Fariba is a very artistic person, so that's going to be pretty, pretty amazing.
Well, I hope everybody is now excited and wants to come to the conference, because I think it's just a wonderful, rewarding experience.
The 12th.
Okay. Oh, it looks like we have a caller. Let me see who it is here in just a second. Looks like Rebecca from California. Rebecca, do you have a question for us?
Yes, I do. I have a three-year-old son who has he has pretty severe food allergies. The worst is to corn, and then he also has PDD, pervasive developmental disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that his nightmares and night terrors are directly related to how much corn he has taken, is in his diet, you know, by accident. And when we've completely eliminated the his offending foods, then they go away. And I was kind of wondering if you had a comment on that or could explain that. Or...
Yeah, Tori. Mm. Well, it's the first time I've heard about this, and it's surprising, but maybe not so surprising. There are so many different substances that can affect nightmares, and the fact that you've been observing carefully diet in relation to nightmares, I think, is to your credit. And, I mean, it seems to me you're handling it well. You know, there's a lot of skepticism about whether foods affect nightmares.
Mm-hmm.
This old, what's called the pickled walnut theory of nightmares, that if you eat pickled walnuts before bed, you'll have nightmares. And you know, people have attributed nightmares to all kinds of things, pizza and so forth. And today, there's more skepticism that food has any effect on dreams. But I personally tend to think that it does.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly if it is an allergy.
Yeah, food intolerances and food allergies. You know, there's a lot of things we don't know about food intolerances. Their effects on mood, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I have heard about studies where they've done on prisoners, among others, where they vary the nature of the diet, and they find that the prisoners become more or less aggressive depending on the foods that they're given.
Mm-hmm.
So if you see a link with this food allergy, I would think, you know, pay careful attention to it. And if you can even document it, you know, that would be really useful if you ever need to speak with your doctor about it, because they can be quite skeptical about these kinds of observations. But
I've kept a journal, and it's very clear. And so now I actually can tell, you know, if he's starting to have his night terrors again, then I know that he's reacting to something.
And what kind of symptoms does he have in the waking state when he's eating corn?
When he's awake, that's my two-year-old screaming. Sorry.
that is.
Yeah. No, he gets pain. He gets abdominal pain. So I was also kind of wondering if there was a link between pain and nightmares, if maybe it was from the pain.
It is possible. It's possible that the symptoms themselves are causing the nightmares rather than, you know, the food per se.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps it's causing a depression of mood or, like you say, pain in the stomach. But if you look at the content of the nightmares themselves, they may give you some clues.
Yeah.
Is he dreaming about, you know, having pain somewhere?
Maybe when he's older he'll be able to tell me.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you said he was three. So
well, there certainly is a lot of evidence that pain and tactile sensations on the body invade your dreams. They'll create their own little degrees of imagery in there. So maybe you'll see that in some of the dreams.
We've induced pain while subjects are sleeping in the lab using a blood pressure cuff and inflating it to a high pressure, which is painful. It's not dangerous, but it's painful. And you would be surprised at how bizarre the dreams become.
Huh.
And nightmarish. So, yeah, your idea is a sound one.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for calling in and asking your question.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
All right. Okay, Dr. Nielsen, one of the things that remained unanswered prior to the break And is whether dreams or nightmares plays a role in the healing process. We talked about the extinction process and the fact that, you know, by providing this environment, in this new, more calming environment in face of the fear or the fear memory or the trauma memory, we were able to change a bit, do a little bit of healing. But does the dream or nightmare actually bring that about? Can it bring about the psychological healing?
Well, I tend to think that the dream can, and part of the model that I talked about specifies that, you know, the function of dreaming is to produce fear extinction memories. The key question for me is whether that same function is working during nightmares or whether what we're seeing is dysfunction of that process. And I don't think that the answer is in on that yet. It could very well be that what's happening is both. That is, the dream is attempting, in its way, to deal with the fear or whatever emotion is being processed, but that something goes wrong and it fails. So there's a partial, there's an attempt, maybe even a partial success within the nightmare, but then ultimately it's too much for the mind, and the person will wake up or will break to another dream that's less threatening.
Although I see, you know, when we had Deidre Barrett on, she talked about mastery dreams, where little by little over time, the nightmare does change, the dream does change, as the person begins to take a little mastery over the trauma. And I guess the question is that, are they taking mastery over the trauma as a result of the dream or as a result of daytime, you know, experience and just normal extinction processes?
Right, well, that's an important question. We know that treatment for nightmares seems to work if it's given during the daytime. So presumably whatever is being learned through drawing the dream or mentally rehearsing the dream is generalizing over into the sleep state. But there are instances, other kinds of treatments, for example, lucid dreaming training, where the person learns to actually wake up within the nightmare and then take some action, some mastery over the content of the dream, and that seems to be effective as well. There are examples of that in the literature.
Yeah, that's sort of like the little girl where I told her to hug her monster. Is that what you're talking about?
That's right. You turn around in the nightmare and confront the creature, and often, voila, someone else appears. You know, it's the child's mother or whoever, but a more specific statement of the problem, and the person will feel some relief. So it could go both ways. You know, the mastery could occur within the nightmare, and mastery could occur during the waking state. But we need more research, obviously.
Yeah.
Not too many people studying this question.
And Lainey, I think you had a question about some of the work you was doing in virtual reality.
I like that virtual reality. And you're using it to study the memory sources of dreams?
Yeah. Yeah, this is a whole other branch of research that we're doing, my doctoral student Philip Stenstrom and I. We're quite interested in using virtual reality as a stimulus. In the past, we've used films and other kinds of less realistic stimuli, but here we're using something quite realistic. We immerse the person with the goggles and so forth in a kind of a maze.
Well, we're going to have to take a break here, so I want to hear about that right after we come back. And we'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Troy Nielsen, talking about his virtual reality research.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Dream Science Foundation, in partnership with International Association for the Study of Dreams, welcomes all who are interested in understanding dreams from the perspective of the researchers and professionals in the field. This show is sponsored by DreamScience.org in conjunction with the International Association for the Study of Dreams and by the book Dream Language by Robert Haas, which contains topics from this series and content from many of the guests who are appearing. Join us at the annual conference for the International Association for the Study of Dreams, June 29th through July 3rd at Sonoma State University. University in California for over 160 presentations from all over the globe on dreams and dream work. For more information on this conference or to order Bob's book, Dream Language, visit www.asdreams.org or www.dreamscience.org.
Hey, Ranger, why do you have to remind people to be careful with fire?
Well, Mr. Mountain Lion, sometimes people need to be reminded about certain things, like not to run with scissors or let children play with wild dingoes, and to be responsible for fires they start.
So what you're saying is that people can be careless and forgetful?
Pretty much.
That makes me very sad.
Sounds like someone needs a hug.
Back off or I'll turn your hat into confetti!
Remember, only you can prevent wildfires. A public service message from Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ag Council.
Jack LaLanne.com presents Jack LaLanne Live on the Voice America Health and Wellness Radio Network. Each week, Jack is joined by Elaine LaLanne and his nephew, bodybuilder, kinesiologist, and personal trainer, Chris LaLanne, to answer your questions and help you overcome your fitness roadblocks. That's three times the diet and fitness know-how. Three times the entertainment. Tune in every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific to Jack LaLanne Live on the Voice America Health and Wellness Radio Network.
Helping you make informed decisions for your life. This is Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to Dreamtime with Bob Haas. If you have a question or comment, call us toll-free at 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Bob.
Welcome back to Dreamtime. Today we're discussing dreams and nightmare research in Canada with our guest, Dr. Tori Nielsen, director of the Dream and Nightmare Laboratory in Montreal. Well, before we went on break, Tori, you were talking about the research you're doing with virtual reality. That sounded pretty interesting.
Well, yeah, we find it quite interesting. It's combining two areas that haven't really been combined, but that I think are closely related. I mean, a lot of people think of dreaming as a kind of virtual reality, you know, the creation of a whole new environment through which we move and act. And we like using virtual reality because it does have this spatial aspect, this immersive aspect, and we know that this engages certain brain areas like the hippocampus and the place cells that are so popular now. And we're using it to study how people incorporate bits of reality into their dreams. And we're finding that it is something, even a 20-minute immersion in our virtual labyrinth or maze is enough to affect dreams for the subsequent weeks. And we're particularly interested in tracing what we call the dream lag effect, and that is the fact that people will dream about something like this immediately the first chance they get, the first night after going through the VR. But and then they'll stop dreaming about it for a couple of days. And then at around days 5, 6, 7, they'll start dreaming about it again. And that's what we call the dream lag effect, as opposed to the day residue effect that Freud studied, you know, the first day after. And we still don't know what this means. We've replicated it numerous times, and now we're finding that the VR is a very good stimulus for producing this this dream lag effect.
And what kind of virtual reality do you do when the patient is like, what are they seeing?
Well, they're put into a maze in which they need to find their way out. So the maze consists of three different environments. Each one is quite distinct. One, for example, is a winter scene where they're running, and they can navigate using a mouse, and they can turn their head and look around up and down at where they are, and they can move around through the maze. And once they find their way out of this one environment, say the winter environment, they go down a corridor into another environment, which is also a maze.
It's like Alice through the Looking Glass.
Yeah, it really it
well,
has
this
that
is,
aspect.
This is a lot like what Jane Gockenbach talked to us about a couple weeks ago, where she's looking at the effects of media, electronic media and game playing and stuff like that on dreams. So it sounds like you're seeing very much the same sort of thing here.
Yeah, it's true. We're the only difference is we're not studying so much gamers.
Yeah, exactly.
Our gamers are our students who are actually programming the VR world.
But the virtual reality is similar kind of environment where they find this affecting their dreams. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they get a chance to find themselves out of the maze. Is that it?
Yep, they do. And the mazes are set up so that we can easily track them in the dreams. Like I mentioned, a winter environment, a junkyard, a forest environment. These have attributes that are quite easy to track, you know, snow, ice, references to metal and junk and so forth. So we have a grid that we use to score the dreams that people keep at home in diaries.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're having our subjects type out their dreams and actually email them to us. And we're using electronic text mining procedures to analyze the dreams. We're trying to improve our methods of dream analysis by using these algorithms.
And they're finding these mazes appearing in their dreams or this experience in their dreams?
Yeah, they are usually fragmentary.
Yeah.
People just do not seem to incorporate whole hog,
yeah,
their reality, into their dreams. But they and I think this reflects on how people encode reality. The brain takes in different channels of information, and these channels are accessed separately,
yeah,
during...
Well, David Kahn also talked about the fact that episodic memory is pretty well shut off when you're dreaming, so that probably,
yeah,
has a lot to do with it.
Right.
I've got to ask you about another area that you're working on, and that's this felt present experiences. Can you say a few words about that?
Yeah, felt presence. This is an area particularly close to me. It's felt presence is a phenomenon in which we experience the presence of another person close by, even though there is no necessarily sensory information to tell us that another is there. I say person, it could be an entity, it could be, you know, a spirit, it could be an animal creature. Yet we don't necessarily see anything or hear anything or feel being touched or anything like this. It's a sense presence. It's a purely spatial type of illusion that we have. And it's most obvious during sleep paralysis attacks. Sleep paralysis is a kind of benign sleep problem that maybe a quarter of the population has experienced at one time or another, usually when they're younger, but being paralyzed at the transition between wakefulness and sleep. A person feels awake. They are aware of being in the bedroom, of lying down, of being in their home, yet they continue to dream. They continue to have these vivid hallucinations, and in particular of the presence. That's probably the most common one. Mm-hmm. The presence will be sensed to come into the room, come close to the bed. Sometimes will be even felt to climb onto the bed, and in more extreme cases, to climb onto the body. I've even heard accounts of the presence going into the body, or you know, there are these violent assaults and molestations that have been reported as well. So it can be very, very vivid, or it can be very subtle, just a brief sense of a presence in the room when there's really no one there.
Yeah. So you have any conclusions or theories as to what that might be?
Well, my take on this is that it's a more general thing than simply sleep paralysis. It's always been treated as a symptom of sleep paralysis, but I think that the felt presence is something that is part, reflects something about the human mind, the social nature of the human mind.
Mm.
We can't really imagine existing without other people, and those other people are probably genetically coded into our brains. So we think about other people throughout the day. We plan our days around, our activities around other people, and sometimes these what I call social images manifest in this particular way. And it takes a particular situation for the images to occur like this, but I've talked about, for example, new mothers having dreams of their infant. Well, these are presence phenomena. These are the felt presence of the child in the bed without necessarily seeing the child or touching the child. This is why I study that phenomenon. We see it also after someone has died. The presence of the deceased is very often felt to exist in the house for days, weeks, even years after the person has died. Spouses will tell you this. It's a very common, and it's not considered to be pathological either. People at high altitudes, hiking in the mountains alone, will sometimes experience the companionship of another, of an entity. There are numerous situations.
It's not necessarily happening in sleep.
No, it's just a really conducive state for the presence to emerge.
Right.
We're studying some of the psychological attributes of people who have them. We found connections with social phobia and social anxiety. Others have reported relationships with depression. So there may be, you know, a psychopathological aspect to these. That is, people who have social phobia may be more likely to have them. But I don't, in general, think that it's a pathological phenomenon.
Well, I feel the presence of the music in the background, unfortunately, so it seems like the time is up for this segment.
Well, I feel your presence fading, Bob.
Right. I want to thank both Dr. Troy Nielsen and Lainey Dolphin for the show. It was really wonderful.
I enjoyed being here.
And please go to jtkresearch.com/dreamlab for information on how you might participate in Tori's Internet Dream Studies. Next week is the final week of our show, and we'll be talking about the significance of color in dreams, some research that I myself have done, and some of the other research that's gone on with color. This was featured in Reader Digest last year as well, so it's a pretty interesting topic in terms of color. I will be joined by my co-host Lynn Haas, who's my wife and director of energy psychology programs at Intersource. So we'll see you then.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to Dreamtime. For more information on dreams, visit www.asdreams.org. That's www.asdreams.org. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday for another educational hour with Bob Haas and Dreamtime.